Film Spotting is brought to you by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting. And by All the King's Men. Oscar winner Sean Penn leads the star-studded cast, which includes Oscar nominee Jude Law, Oscar nominee Kate Winslet, and Oscar winner Sir Anthony Hopkins. All the King's Men is in theaters September 22nd.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Sam Van Holgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Coming up on this week's show, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, new music from Richard Buckner, and the second film in our documentaries marathon, Harlan County, USA.
Plus, this week's top five, our most anticipated movies of the fall. But first, a week after failing to solve the mysterious death of Superman, we return to the crime scene for Brian De Palma's The Black Dahlia.
Great test, Elizabeth Shaw.
Don't walk out on me, Richard. Say you care, say
that you... Short! This is a very sad scene. Do you think you're capable of playing sadness?
I can do that.
Her name was Elizabeth Short. She was young and beautiful, determined to be famous, but destined to be infamous.
On January 15, 1947, the body of 22-year-old Medford, Massachusetts native and aspiring actress Elizabeth Short was found cut in half and mutilated in a Los Angeles vacant lot. The Blue Dahlia, a 1946 film starring Alan Ladd and Veronica Lake, would inspire Short's posthumous nickname, Black Dahlia. The case, contrary to what transpires at the end of Brian De Palma's new film, remains unsolved. As the end credits make clear, De Palma's movie is merely inspired by the Black Dahlia murder, but is based on James Ellroy's 1998 eponymous novel, a fictional account that centers around the two LAPD cops, both former boxers, who are investigating the case, Mr. Fire, Lee Blanchard, played by Aaron Eckhart, and Mr. Ice, Bucky Bleichert, played by Josh Hartnett. Not unlike the movie we reviewed last week, Hollywoodland, the victim story plays second string to the downward spiral of those on the periphery. Sam, Short wanted to be in the Flickers, as one character refers to the movie business, and considering the setting and her movie-inspired nickname, it's not a surprise that De Palma, perhaps the ultimate movie geek director with his elaborate long takes and assorted visual flourishes, would load the Black Dahlia with numerous film noir references. Double Indemnity, The Lady in the Lake, and Chinatown are just a few of the films that De Palma pays direct tribute to. Voiceover narration, femme fatales, anti-hero detectives, sex, corruption, slanted camera angles, almost every film noir convention you can rattle off, you'll find in The Black Dahlia. But you'll also find something that is rarely associated with the humorless depravity of film noir, camp. Do you have any idea what De Palma is up to here, and does it work?
Oh, boy. I'm so glad you brought up this idea of camp, because I walked out of this movie, too, thinking, like, what I wanted to make sure I wasn't alone. And I went to see it with my wife, and I was like, there was a camp element to that film, wasn't there? And she wasn't actually able to confirm it. But I was thinking about it, and I think camp, in a way, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, I can see it as the sort of last resort or last defense of failed ambition in some way. You throw up your hands, you throw reality and coherence out the window, and you throw your characters and your actors on the mercy of the audience, and they maybe can have some fun with it. Go ahead, Fiona Shaw, do your best Joan Crawford in, you know, whatever happened to Baby Jane impression, and have a lot of fun. This movie is a fiasco, a true fiasco. And I say that with almost some tenderness, because it's not just a disaster. You know, it's not just a failure. I don't want to play nice with Brian De Palma anymore. You know, I think I've shown a lot of restraint and respect for the director, based largely on the fact that Quentin Tarantino claims De Palma is one of his favorite directors. Pauline Kael, famous defender of De Palma.
Like I said, I mean, he's kind of the movie geeks, director.
Yeah, right. And I looked back at his last three films that I've seen of his, Femme Fatale, Mission Impossible, Mission to Mars. I hated every single one of these movies. Hated them. I didn't just dislike them. I hated them. There was something incoherent and boring and embarrassing about every single one of them. This movie, when I say it's a fiasco, I mean that, you know, at the beginning, I was just kind of bored by the incoherence of it. I couldn't really follow what was going on. I didn't understand any of the characters' motivations. And then about halfway through, this movie started to get funny bad. Mm-hmm. And I realized I was rooting for it to get even worse.
Yeah, and it does.
And it does. it's amazing. And I imagine, you know, I saw this on a Saturday afternoon with maybe 15 people in the audience, but I guarantee somebody had this experience out there. Maybe they were in Midtown Manhattan, packed house, Black Dahlia. This film is getting uproarious laughter. I guarantee.
Well,
I wish I had had that experience, because I was laughing out loud, not just at what Fiona Shaw was doing, and I do not blame her, nor do I blame any of the actors, really. I blame De Palma. This movie is an embarrassment.
Yeah, I'm actually with you, and I have seen some comments on Metacritic where a few critics were saying, it's not De Palma's fault here, it's the acting.
Oh,
and they're
God,
wrong.
They're so
wrong. It's De Palma's fault.
Fiona Shaw walked in there with that as original choice.
Or Aaron Eckhart with what he does with Lee Blanchard. And we'll get into all of that. Well, maybe not all of that. Scarlett Johansson and Josh Hartnett, will see where we fall
with those.
They may
have to take the blame.
But
themselves.
The people who are really over the top, who are campy, yeah. I don't blame them at all.
No,
you
Hilary
know,
Swank.
Yeah, it had to be a choice that De Palma worked with them on and gave them. So it wasn't something they did. I agree with you there. But I want to give De Palma the benefit of the doubt, too. He's Brian De Palma. He made Carrie, and, you know, a lot of people really love him. People I respect, just friends of mine, but other filmmakers, you're right, and other critics.
Right.
And so I walk out of it almost trying to come up with an explanation for the camp. And I wonder if it is intentional. Because in some way, maybe he's trying to comment on film noir. It's his way of subverting the genre. In a film that is otherwise very loyal to the conventions, as I said, a film noir, he is very loyal to it. But at the same time, there is something you see in the lighting, for example, which is totally contradictory to film noir. Some scenes are they're so bright, they're overexposed, which you never get, obviously, in a noir, where it's where it comes from. It's dark, the shadows, you know, the black and white. And here, it's so colorful and bright, it's kind of odd in a way. And then you add into it the fact that from the very beginning, it's so stylized that, again, you almost feel like he knows what he's doing with it a little bit. The fight scene, the movie opens with his mob scene, and everything about it just reeks of movie set.
Yeah.
The choreography of the fight.
So stagey.
Everything about it is so stagey.
Yeah.
And he goes so far with it that you almost have to read it as intentional camp, I think.
Know.
And,
I
you know, maybe that is his spin, ultimately, on the noir and his shot at Hollywood. And the upper class, in some way, is that the only way to portray the total ridiculousness of these people. These people, they're power-hungry, they're money-hungry people, is to portray them as absolutely ridiculous. Literally, that's his satire, maybe, in a way.
If it is, becomes, it's lazy, in a way.
Well, it is, I agree, but that's my explanation, is like I'm trying to come up with one, and that's the best one I can come up with. And I mentioned the beginning, you have this camp stylized factor right from the beginning, but it kind of dissipates a little bit until you get to the murder. And Aaron Eckhart, who I loved at the beginning, I thought his stylized acting fit right in with the style of the movie.
In a way.
And his energy, it was so much bigger.
It was still
and
hard
better.
To understand what his motivations
yeah,
were.
Yeah, but he was
but
still interesting.
I agree.
And so much better and more interesting than Scarlett Johansson and Josh Hartnett. He's just so much more charismatic. I was really into him. But then after the murder, something happens he becomes totally laughable.
It's the Bennies.
Yeah,
he's on the Bennies.
Maybe, yeah, exactly, which comes out of nowhere, right?
You never see him pop in the
never
Ben's
once.
Dream.
And literally people in the theater, I was watching it, people were laughing.
They were,
at that.
Okay,
they
good.
Were.
I wasn't
And he's not believable. That's the problem in any of those moments. He's supposed to be totally obsessed with this Dahlia murder. But the problem is, we never actually see him build to obsession.
Never.
He just starts obsessed.
And it's never
like,
justified.
All of a sudden, yeah, like all of a sudden he's just like
completely
off the rails. He's crazy about this case. Like in the first scene, we see him investigating
I have
it.
To wonder, too, if after they filmed it and they're like, oh, we forgot to build in a justification for him acting completely bats. And you wonder if they went in and threw a couple scenes in where he's on Benzedrine.
Yeah.
Where they just added those scenes later.
I know, I know. And by the last 30 minutes, though, you get the mother character, Ramona,
Fiona
who is Fiona
Shaw,
who I saw in London portray Richard.
Great
the
classical
second.
Actress.
She is a very good actress, and you get to her scenes at the end in this rushed conclusion of the last 30 minutes. You're right, the movie's just okay bad for a while,
right.
And then it goes completely off the tracks, and it becomes just the rushed conclusion. I mean, the last 30 minutes, it tries to
introducing
tie everything
characters
up.
You've never seen.
Exactly,
I mean,
and don't care about. It does devolve into full-blown camp, and I would equate it to a soap opera, but frankly, that's too much of an insult to people who write for
melodrama.
Soap operas.
It's
total melodrama.
That's what's really strange.
The dialogue, some of it between Johansson and Hartnett, is
brutal.
Excruciating. The final scene with Hilary Swank and Hartnett, I mean, everything about it, the way it's shot, the dialogue, the way it's performed, is terrible. And, of course, Fiona Shaw doing her best Faye Dunaway / Joan Crawford impression. I mean, it becomes hysterical. And I mean hysterical not only in that it is funny, but just like it's so big and over the top. It's mind-blowing,
It really is. And I remember thinking early on, actually, when I hadn't quite realized the campiness of it, when it was just not working for me. Because, first of all, you pointed this out. We've got a mystery that we're not following the mystery ever. There's a scene, like, really, like, 10 minutes to the end, all of a sudden Hartnett's actually doing some investigation work, but not really, not like a real police officer would.
No.
And I started thinking about Brick. You know, our other noir movie of the year, and how we went into Brick, I think we both went into Brick, being very suspicious of this high school noir. And I think when I was talking about my preview, all I thought, imagined, worst case scenario, we just imagined, you imagined that being campy. Mm-hmm. I imagined it being campy, where it's like, we wouldn't really take it seriously. It was very tongue-in-cheek. That's what I was imagining. Turns out it was just brilliant noir, updated. This reminded me of what my fears of Brick were going to be. This was people play-acting noir, especially... just the terrible miscasting of, like, Hartnett. I mean, I don't dislike him as much as you do, but again, here's another Hartnett in my now least favorite film of the year, like he was in Lucky Number 11. I don't think he's terrible in this. Again, he's just
he's terribly miscast. Yes, he is.
And Scarlett Johansson, again, much, much too young to be filling out this role, especially directed by Brian De Palma. And it's just, it's weird play-acting melodrama noir, which is just such a strange combination.
You're exactly right. I made a note, too, about the Brick factor, because Rian Johnson talked about it. He talked about how whenever he told people what the film was about, like Chinatown goes to high school or whatever, people immediately have these images of, you know, what's that terrible movie he mentioned, the Scott Baio one? I'm losing the name. Bugsy Malone.
Oh, yeah.
Like kids acting like they're in a film noir, and how much they strive to avoid that, because then, I mean, that thought of that would just be so excruciating. And by the end of this film, that's what you have here. You have characters play acting. You have Josh Hartnett essentially trying to be Sam Spade, trying to be Philip Marlowe, and it's so hard to take. And the whole film just feels like that. It feels like it's trying to be that as opposed to just being something in its own contained universe, which Brick is. And you're right. I mean, Scarlett Johansson, I've said before, I understand why people love her, not just because she's attractive, obviously, but because
she's been in quality, and
she's been in roles that I do like, and I like the films. I like Lost in Translation, and I like her character.
Ghost World.
I like her in Ghost World. I like her even in The Man Who Wasn't There. I mean, you know, so
the horse
I can
whisperer.
See. I didn't see it, sorry, but I can see why people like her. But the fact is, going back to Match Point, a film I loved, she's kind of a femme fatale in that a little bit, and I didn't like her in that. And here, the first time we meet her, she walks into this, I think it's the first time we see her, or maybe the second, but she walks into the boxing ring where they're training, and watch her in that scene. She's trying so hard to be Barbara Stanwyck, and she's just not Barbara Stanwyck. She's so fidgety. She's really fidgety, and like Barbara
Stanwyck, she's holding a cigarette holder.
Oh, and everything about the way she moves, and I mean, literally just her mannerisms, they're fidgety, and that does not give you the sensation of someone who's in control and really possessed. And we learn that she's not, but these femme fatales, that's how she's trying to act.
I know.
And like Barbara Stanwyck, you watch her in The Lady Eve, you watch
she just
the stillness.
Is.
She exudes that sensuality. Scarlett Johansson is never sensual in this film. I mean, and even for someone who is as attractive as she is, she's really never sexy in this film.
And I have to blame De Palma there. I mean, really, the movie turned a corner where I had not given up on the movie entirely. Certainly wasn't at the point where I was mocking it. But the corner turned when we see Johansson at the top of the stairs in a ridiculous outfit and then slams the door in Josh Hartnett's face. He's down at the bottom of the stairs and she's wearing this robe that's open, revealing her chest. And it's just a ridiculously melodramatic shot. It's ridiculous because it's Scarlett Johansson. You haven't taken her seriously once. And all of a sudden you're supposed to think that this is just a major insight into what, you know, the mind game she's playing with Josh Hartnett, and you just don't buy it for a single second. And you never buy the relation. I mean, they're supposed to be, I think they're suggesting or implying this seamliness, you know, that's going on. It's like this ménage à trois that's going on between Eckert and Hartnett and Johansson. They're friends and they're maybe lovers and what's going on. And it's just, there's no tension. There's no sexual tension between any of them.
No, there's really not. And unfortunately, the scene, I don't want to give away any of the plot, but later in the film, when they finally, Hartnett and Johansson, consummate their relationship, it's so offensively bad, because you're really supposed to believe the whole time that
they've been building, the tension's been building.
And that they truly love and respect Lee Blanchard, who is her boyfriend, then becomes her husband, I believe, that they truly love him.
Right.
And then you see what they do in the way they do it and in the moment they do it. It doesn't come off the way maybe they want it. It's just this passionate thing at all. It's really embarrassing. And it's and you just think about it. I mean, it just everything you've seen building up to that point about how much they love Aaron Eckhart's character,
right.
It just craps on
Which
all
doesn't
of
really
that.
Make a lot
it
of
undercuts
sense
the entire movie. And I agree with you about Hartnett. He can't pull it off. Noir detectives don't cry, and they have
I
to be
just
mysterious.
Say that exactly.
They have to be mysterious. They have to have some meat to them, and he's just a lug, unfortunately. And I have to say that for me, I'm with you. This film went from a point where it didn't just become bad, but to offensively bad, to I hate it, one-star review bad. I'm with you on this, Sam, because like Hollywoodland, the big mistake this film makes is that it doesn't just trust the detective story. You
At
mentioned
all.
This. It doesn't let it unfold. That movie,
it's like it doesn't even respect the idea that that would be interesting.
I know, and it's so interesting. Obviously, it's unsolved, and all these
you don't
things
even care
about it.
You wonder why anybody cares about
you
Elizabeth
don't.
Short.
I know, and so in Hollywoodland, you had the fall and redemption, right, of Louis Simo was what it was really about. Here, it's this love triangle, and you talk about trivializing something that is really bleak and dark and fascinating, and it just completely trivializes it because it turns this love triangle as something, you know, more important. And here's my Sam Van Halgren moment. I found it in some level to be exploitive and misogynistic, which
absolutely
I guess, you know,
well, De Palma's been, you know,
exactly. It's
you know.
A charge on De Palma for a long time. I usually don't care about that stuff or bring that kind of stuff up necessarily, but like, and I guess it would also tie in nicely with noir on some level is inherently kind of misogynistic. But for them to trivialize this murder in the way they do and then to show us the murder later, to make the choice to show it actually happen later and actually give us the gore, that for me was the final straw where I found it just completely exploitive, just De Palma having his jollies in some way at exploiting this girl and this case. And it's such a fascinating case. And for them to turn it into what they do, it's like Pearl Harbor, right? Like like, you know, this amazing event and turning it into
Dude,
this love triangle.
Fest, love triangle. Yeah.
I'm not equating the Elizabeth Short murder with Pearl Harbor on the grand scale, but it's a fascinating enough conundrum in itself that you just want to see those details unravel, and it never bothers.
Well, it's interesting. De Palma's interviewed in the most recent issue of Entertainment Weekly, and they're sort of going through his filmography and having him describe how he feels about them. And they sort of bring up the charge that he's been accused of misogyny in the past. And this is how he defends it. Basically says, you see a woman on screen and you're just waiting for her to take her clothes off. That I was like, all right, so
I've
maybe...
wanted to say that so many times
on
air.
We all are. That's all we go to the movies for, is waiting for a woman to take their clothes off. I have three words for you to wrap this up. Fire and Ice. Yeah. I want the DVD camp DVD edition to be called Black Dahlia, the Fire and Ice edition.
Uh-huh.
That scene.
That
where
scene.
We, I mean,
yeah. You don't want to give it away.
I think
but...
there's a drinking game that somebody can build around this movie to really make it just a sort of joyous, campy
It's
time.
That bad. It could take
it
on that kind
that
of, like, actually, more fun maybe than Snakes on a Plane.
I agree. I completely agree.
It could
agree.
Be. Okay, my one last point. I got to give a nod to our boy, Scott Smith, who occasionally fills in for you, Sam.
Yeah.
Back when we were discussing our show where he filled in the first time, we were doing our twist endings, and he wrote in. And this is just a nice touch to cap off De Palma here, because you're right. This movie I'm about to mention, you mentioned it. It's a disaster, too. Scott says, I'm thinking about putting Femme Fatale on my list of worst twist endings. He says, or best twist endings. He says, the twist ending to that is you go through the entire film thinking that it's kind of interesting, only to find out in the last 20 minutes that it's a huge piece of crap. And that is kind of what happens
here. Paul does you the favor of pointing out that it's a huge piece of crap much earlier.
Yeah, here he does. You're right. So,
all right. Well, if you've seen The Black Dahlia, and we hope you do. We can't be alone here.
Take friends.
Really do. Bring a sixer. You know, have a good time.
Yeah.
And you agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. We may not get a chance to respond, but we will definitely read your email. I want De Palma's directing license revoked. Do I have that power? Can you invest me with that power?
We'll work on it.
Can the listeners of Film Spotting invest me with that power?
Yeah, I think about the only thing that you could really find interesting on some kind of intellectual level with this film to close out, again, this discussion. I was talking, actually, to a PhD candidate at the University of Iowa, Jesse Schlotterbeck, who has studied film noir, and he mentioned, you know, I talked about some of the references. There is a Chinatown reference I noticed. There's a Double Indemnity reference, Barbara Stanwyck on the balcony. We get that with Fiona Shaw on the balcony.
Yeah.
I told Jesse, I had to admit, I didn't think about Double Indemnity there because I was too busy thinking about, you know, Mommy Dearest in that scene, unfortunately.
Exactly.
And there is a great Lady in the Lake sequence, which that whole movie is told from first person point of view. The whole thing, you don't see the detective, you know, it's his point of view. You get that extended scene here. But like, other than kind
of
geeking out.
And there's the regular Hitchcock references you expect
course.
To see with
yeah,
De Palma.
Yeah, with De Palma. But other than geeking out at those, it's really troubling to sit through. But fun in a way.
But really, it got fun.
Yeah,
it really
it
got fun towards the end.
All right, well, after the break, this business, this town, it chews you up and then spits you out. Listeners share their top five movies about Hollywood next in listener feedback.
Pretty destroyed, coming through.
While it's mostly revered as a component of the James Dean trilogy, I really thought Selma Nao.
This week's edition of Mispronunciations with Sam Van Halgren, brought to you by Pepsi
Minio,
Jazz.
Minio, I know. Pepsi Jazz.
Minio, Sam.
It fuels film spotting.
It does. You got a number of emails from people who...
I know. It was so embarrassing. I knew when it came out of my mouth.
Yeah.
I was actually waiting for you to correct me. Give me another shot at it.
Sometimes you're just on a roll and I let you go. But anyway.
God.
Okay, time to announce this week's PureFlix DVD giveaway winner. We are giving away Star Wars A New Hope, the two-disc set that was just released on DVD last week. And we'd like to congratulate Dylan Dively of Carroll Stream, Illinois. Look for your copy of Star Wars soon, courtesy of PureFlix.
Yeah, sign up for a free PureFlix account now by going to PureFlix.com/filmspotting or filmspotting.net. And you'll be entered to win The Proposition, also out this week, the Rock and Rydell edition of Grease.
You know
Adam.
I'm all over it.
Pre-ordered on Amazon. Brain Damage, horror classic.
So to speak.
The Devil and Daniel Johnston and Hard Candy with Ellen Page, a film that a lot of our listeners wrote in about, loved Ellen Page's performance in that. I couldn't get excited about this film. It just
looked
kind of brutal.
But I do want to see it, and now that it's out, we will.
All right.
You're saying all right?
You're the boss.
Oh, come on.
I mean, no,
doing our end of the
not.
Year list, you're not going to see Hard
oh,
Candy.
Oh, God. There's so much out there.
Okay. Well, we'll get to it eventually. But we should mention we are giving away The Proposition.
Yes.
That was our choice. John Hillcoat, Australian take riff on the Western. And Guy Pearce, really kind of underused in that, unfortunately. But Ray Winston, Emily Watson,
amazing.
One of my top five films of the year so far. I don't think it was on your top five, but you liked it a
lot.
No, but
Winston's
as well.
Performance, certainly. I mean, it's just fantastic.
Yeah. We also wanted to announce something we're pretty excited about, which is our PureFlix commercial contest.
Right.
We were thinking that it would be really fun to incorporate some of your PureFlix stories into
your
the show.
Testimonials,
your testimonials as commercials for the show. And PureFlix liked the idea so much that they're ponying up to the winner $100 worth of free DVDs.
Nice.
So you pick them, $100 worth of DVDs. And at first I was talking to Dan at PureFlix and he said, you know, get your choice of a DVD up to $30. And I said, you know, that's good. I think someone would do it. And he goes, you know what? $100.
Yeah.
It's like, wow. I mean, that's...
They go a long way towards that new Janus, like, multi-volume set release of all those classic films, I think in association with Criterion. I mean,
what's coming out?
Well, it's just like a 25-volume set of all these Janus, really classic Janus releases.
There you go. Okay, so plenty to spend your money on, $100 worth. And basically, here's how it works. You have until Sunday, October 8th.
Right.
And you can already read some of our testimonials on our site under the PureFlix ad. Some of you have sent these in unsolicited.
Right.
Your PureFlix stories of getting the Godfather trilogy by trading, you know, three crappy
Snow
DVDs.
Patrol, who knows?
Yeah, whatever. And we want to hear those stories.
Yeah.
You've traded something, got something good. We just got one this week from Aaron Walker,
who
mentioned that he traded Hooper, the Burt Reynolds
the Burt
DVD.
Reynolds classic.
I can't remember what he got, but something he'd always wanted. And so, anyway, we want that story from you. We're going to judge it on creativity, I guess, and entertainment value and substance.
The same criteria you use to judge us every
exactly.
week.
Exactly. So send us an MP3 file, 30 seconds long, or send us your written story, and if we really like it, we will go ahead and record it and use it. But you have until Sunday, October 8th, $100 worth of free DVDs. Share us your favorite PureFlix story so far. We also wanted to thank this week, Sam, everyone who was really generous. And we've moved the donations and the nicknames over to the website, but we have a couple people we just feel like we have to thank.
Very generous
on air
this
here.
Week. We want to thank Gold Club member Kelvin, the Hollywood Hitman, and Silver Club member Marta Midnight Mayhem. Everyone else that donated this week, yes, go to the website. Your nicknames will be posted along with everyone else's on the website. So
that's
check that out.
We do have a link on our site. You'll find it in the notes for this show, so check that out. Poll questions, Sam. Last week we asked, tying in with the movies that were opening this week, and we mentioned that we might be reviewing The Last Kiss, and we should say, actually, we've just decided to push Last Kiss back for a week. We're going to discuss The Last Kiss on our WBEZ edition
with
All the King's Men. We saw The Black Dahlia, and we did ask, which new movie will you see this weekend? The Black Dahlia, The Last Kiss, we'll see both, yep. or looks like I'm staying home.
Yeah, 38% of you, actually a tie for the top slot here. 38% of you said that you looks like you're staying home when given that choice, and 38% of you said you're going to go see The Black Dahlia. So that means a fair number of people went to see The Black Dahlia. We can't wait to hear what you thought, obviously.
Yes.
Only 14%, and I'm really surprised.
I'm surprised, too. I thought Last Kiss might win it.
I did, too. 14% of you said The Last Kiss. Yeah, Zach Braff, Garden State Love. I can't believe more people aren't excited about this. And 10% said you'll go and see them both. So we'll say that's 24%, actually. A quarter of you said you'll go see The Last Kiss.
That's true, if they're going to see both. But anyway, that was last week's poll question. This week's poll question, tying in with our top five this week, we'll get into it more later, why we're doing it. But the question is, which of these fall releases are you most excited to see?
Yeah, Babel, Borat, The Departed, The Prestige, and or Science of Sleep.
Michelle Gondry film. So we're not going to give away our votes yet because we're going
to
save it for the top five. But those were five we picked, and you'll probably hear all five of them come up in some way, whether it's in our top five or six through ten.
Right.
We want to know which movie you're most excited about. Go to filmspotting.net and vote in that. Sam, you also wanted to share a story. You wanted to just mention a couple of movies you recently saw, and at least one of them we're going to talk about later on the show.
Absolutely. This past weekend, actually, it just wrapped up the end of this weekend, the Milwaukee Lesbian, Gay, Bi, and Transsexual Film Festival, Film and Video Film Festival, had a U.S. premiere of John Cameron Mitchell's Short Bus, a film getting a lot of buzz. We're really looking forward to it. We loved Hedwig and the Angry Inch. And really, this came up suddenly. It was added to their lineup just a couple of weeks ago, just before the festival opened. And really, U.S. premiere of this much anticipated film. And I did get to see it. Unfortunately, I cannot comment on it at this point
because we're going to review it.
You haven't seen it. I am dying to talk about this film, but I have to give a little shout out to listener John Jackson, who wrote in and sent the trailer. And I think the unrated trailer.
Yes.
Which I didn't actually see.
You haven't seen, but I watched it.
I have seen the film, but not the trailer. You watched it.
Yeah.
John, you know, wrote to us saying, have you seen the trailer for John Cameron Mitchell's sexually explicit new movie, Short Bus? And it is sexually explicit. In fact, it's infamous, if you've heard about it at all, infamous for the fact that it actually has people engaging in real sex on screen.
Right.
And John warns me to close my eyes as I watch the trailer.
Uh-huh.
Close my eyes.
Because he knows you, Sam. He knows your upbringing.
Well, I had my eyes open through the entire film, and I can't wait to talk about it. Also wanted to mention listener Scott Milder, who wrote in about this other film that happened to be playing at the Milwaukee Gay and Lesbian Film Festival, Red Doors, by writer-director Georgia Lee, about this Chinese-American family. And I did get a chance to see it, and Scott worked on the film. He's a film student, was an intern, a poor, lowly intern on Red Doors, but really liked it. And I liked it, too. The performances are particularly strong. I didn't love the film, and I don't know, and I guess it won a Best Feature award at the Tribeca Film Festival earlier this year. It is interesting, and again, if you're going to see it, it's worth seeing for some of the performances. The three women that make up the family, three sisters that make up the family, are all really, really wonderful actresses. But if it happens to be coming to your city through in a festival or otherwise, I think it is probably worth checking out. Certainly worth paying attention to once it gets a DVD release.
Okay, well, we'll put a link to Red Doors, to that website, on our site in the show notes. We'll also post a link to the unrated trailer for John Cameron Mitchell's Short Bus.
Do not open it at work.
And that's all I'm saying is don't open it at work. Maybe don't even open it with your significant other around. It's pretty racy stuff, to say the least. So let's also read some feedback here. This ties in with something we brought up last week in listener feedback. My trip down memory lane, my cousin Julie wrote in, mentioned Star Wars and how I used to play with all the Star Wars stuff as a kid. And Ty Kim writes in and says, I wanted to thank Adam and also Julie, Adam's cousin, for reminding me about that little Star Wars handheld movie camera. A rush of nostalgia came in my head as soon as I heard that. I remember watching that reel frame by frame, forwards and backwards. It starts from the opening scene of the battle cruiser firing on the rebel ship to rescuing Princess Leia, and it ends with that last TIE fighter explosion when Han and Luke were in the Millennium Falcon. And I wanted to read this, thank you, Ty, because of the fact that I told you that I had forgotten about it until I was reading Julie's email. And then I could start to picture certain scenes in my head. But when I read Ty's email, talk about a blast from the past, I remembered that that is exactly how it started, watching this hand crank thing. And I think our friend M. Robert Turnage sent us a link to one available somewhere, but it's different.
Yeah.
It's not the same one I had.
Well, he's saying he couldn't find, actually, the Star Wars viewer, but
It was
actually
incredible,
just
though.
Us talking about it last week, there was a kind of nostalgic feel I was having. I was talking about the AT-AT and Empire Strikes Back, and These last three, the prequels, the Star Wars prequels, have truly tainted my experience, my early love for Star Wars.
Really?
I realized just because talking about it, I got excited about seeing those first
again.
Three films again.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I want to mention, too, because we didn't mention it, we put it up after the fact, but I happened to come across some home video.
Yeah.
Super 8mm footage that I just recently had transferred to DVD. And if you go to the show notes for Film Spotting 124,
right. You
will find a link down in the link section that is about 30 seconds of footage of me very young, maybe about 3, at Christmas playing with some TIE Fighter footage.
Audio, unfortunately.
Thanks. There's no audio,
really,
but you can tell that I'm making the noises with my mouth, which is really funny.
With your dad looking just mangly on. Yeah.
And then it fast forwards to a few years in the future, I think, and I've got the Han Solo gun, the blaster, and I'm actually, you can't see it in the video, but I'm actually wearing a Han Solo sweatshirt. It says Han Solo on the front and Star Wars on the back.
You were spoiled, Rob.
Yeah, and I had the gun, and I'm running around pretending like I'm in the movie, and I'm like 5. This is easily circa 1980. It's great stuff. Anyway,
I didn't see where you had dressed your sister up as, or one of your sisters up as Princess Leia.
No, we didn't, but put some muffins on her
ears
or whatever. But anyway,
exactly.
If you want to go see Adam Kepinar circa 1980, click on the link in Film Spotting 124.
Yeah.
We also wanted to read this one from Aaron Malone that's pretty funny. We talk about these coincidences a lot on the show, and there was one that we completely failed to mention on air, another one.
Yeah, Aaron writes, I did find it interesting that you did the whole review of the Dylan documentary, Don't Look Back, even saying that he's still a force in music today, without acknowledging the extraordinarily Dylan-esque character of the Dan Byrne music you were playing. I'm curious, was it a conscious choice or yet another bit of coincidence spotting? In any case, I love the music, and I'm going to get a copy of his new album, Breathe, which I think you said was released
just out this week, I believe, or last week, on CD, and I hope Aaron does check it out. But it's funny, it is just another example of coincidence spotting, pure and simple. The album
amazing.
Was coming out.
I almost mentioned it. It's
I
funny.
Emailed
yeah.
you, Sam. I said, we got to play the new Dan Byrne. It's coming out. We just recently got it in the mail. And then I was on my way to work listening to the new Dan Byrne album a couple days after we had recorded the show.
Yeah.
And I'm driving, and it hits me. I start thinking about how I had the opportunity once to interview Dan Byrne, and I was thinking about the questions I asked him, you know, just stream of consciousness while I'm driving. And I remember that one of my questions that I ended up putting in my final production piece, it was a radio piece, was, how do you feel about the comparisons to Bob Dylan?
Somebody plagued by
He always hears that because of his voice and the folk thing and the harmonica, acoustic guitar, whatever. And I asked him that question. And then I went, wait a second. We reviewed Don't Look Back in the same show. We played the new Dan Byrne.
Unmentioned.
Yeah, but and we did not mention it, and we should have. But another one that's interesting that is coming up are political movies, which we think we're going to do, tying in with All the King's Men. And our documentaries, Hearts and Minds, about Vietnam. So these things just have a way of working out somehow.
There's only 3 movies out there.
I guess.
Musicians. And
that's it. We got also this one from David Hudson, a.k.a. David Van Hudson.
The Van Hudson.
About Hollywoodland.
DVH.
Yep, who mentions, I was going to see Hollywoodland this afternoon, the movie we reviewed last week. Yeah. Fortunately, I listened to your podcast before I went, or I never would have known that Robin Tunney was in the movie. My intense dislike for this actress is a source of great humor to my wife. I can't really decide what I hate more, her voice or her open-mouthed expression of disbelief. So thanks for the warning, as I will now avoid Hollywoodland for the rest of my life.
My theory?
Yeah.
My theory? David Van Hudson loves Robin Tunney.
That's it.
He's trying to keep it from his wife.
Yeah.
Clearly. The wife, the fact that he brought in the wife into this anecdote, that she thinks it's funny how much he hates her, clearly a sign that he absolutely adores Robin Tunney.
Wife.
Although I know exactly what he was talking about
with
when he described the open mouth expression.
I did too. I read the email and I went,
so right.
Oh God, that's like the whole film. Her open mouth expression.
But I loved her in Hollywoodland.
I know you did. That's why I wanted to read it. You loved her in Hollywoodland. I liked her
too.
And
in Secret Life of Dentist, she's really good too. I think it's the only other thing I've seen her in.
Really?
She's really good in there.
Well, anyway, we also had someone who took issue with my characterization of the great Adrian Brody's performance.
Yes.
This from Brett Shady in North Hollywood, CA. I wouldn't call the performance as great in Hollywoodland. It felt like a high school version of L.A. Confidential to me. Watching Adrian Brody's acting style suddenly switch to tough guy mode once he has bruise makeup on his face made me cringe.
So interesting.
I don't get that at all. I mean, I don't see how his character actually changed once he had the makeup on.
No,
actually,
I didn't either.
What I see is less tough guy and more just like completely defeated, down
vulnerable,
in the dumps,
vulnerable.
But anyway, that was my take,
to
and I think he's
own.
Good. Yeah, okay.
All right, this one, getting to a bit of top 5 movies about Hollywood.
Yeah.
This one's from Colin Sharkskin Revolver Epstein, who writes, hey, Film Spotters, when you guys started your discussion of your top 5 movies about Hollywood, I was hoping there'd be an outside chance of a dark horse-like Day of the Locust making it in there. So I was very pleasantly surprised to hear that this very dark, relatively little-known film had made the cut. For you, Adam, it was on your list,
yes,
to give you credit. This movie was so stirringly This movie so stirringly recreates the seamy underside of 30s Hollywood that while I've only seen it once, I've never forgotten it. While it's deservedly infamous for the creepy, predatory nature of Karen Black's character and the horrific, surreal climax of mob hysteria, I was knocked out by something else. Billy Barty could really act. The little person who spent a lifetime in show business ranging from Busby Berkeley musicals to George Lucas's Willow gives the performance of his career in Day of the Locust. Do you confirm that? Yeah.
Well, you know, it's been a while since I've seen Day of the Locust, and of course I remember Billy Barty in it, but I don't remember his performance moving me.
Yeah.
But I don't really doubt Colin's interpretation or impression of that at all, and it's nice to see that, you know, someone out there also appreciates Day of the Locust.
Yeah.
And we got along with that. John Heberle, Bay Village, Ohio, he wasn't alone. A lot of people wrote in about my comment how
right.
Donald Sutherland plays a character called Homer Simpson and how much of that was
we imagine
an
it
influence.
Couldn't possibly be a coincidence.
Yeah, and so he claims anyway, and I think this was the general
consensus,
gist we got from everyone, was that Homer is Matt Groening's Homer is Matt Groening's father, Groening. Now I'm mispronouncing.
I love that you're asking
Simpsons.
Me.
Yeah, I'm asking you.
How to pronounce a name. That's classic.
Simpsons comes from the fact that they are simpletons. In the commentary from one of the seasons on DVD, Matt, we'll call him,
Matt.
Says it's not an homage or a ripoff to the film, but he could always be lying. And that is what I saw online, is people would say, he says it has nothing to do with Day of the Locust, but everyone kind of admits that, well, he could be just being kind of sneaky. But anyway.
Anyway. Solve that dilemma. This one's from Kevin Crossman of the Frat Pack Tribute podcast. Boy, did you guys blow it. Glamour and underbelly. Why moths are drawn to a flame. Perhaps a bit of local culture, cars, bars, and parties. How about showing some famous locations? Finally, a movie that pays tribute to other films. With this criteria, I can't believe you left off the best movie about Hollywood from the last decade, Swingers. This movie shows it all. Famous sites like the Derby, including the kitchen, the dating culture, and the struggles of someone who leaves everything, including his longtime girlfriend, to pursue his dream in Hollywood. Your top five was definitely not...
Money.
Money. That's
well,
right.
Yeah, Kevin's not alone. A lot of people sent in Swingers. I don't think there's any doubt that we love this film. It's come up numerous times. In fact, it's probably penalty box worthy.
Right.
And it is absolutely all those things you said. It's about Hollywood. It is.
Yes.
They're actors, and I can see it, and about the location. But I think what we decided, Sam, is that it is for us a movie more about L.A. in some way than Hollywood.
And it's a fine line, we know, but
You know, of course, Singing in the Rain isn't about, you know, the seaminess of Hollywood either, but on the whole, that was kind of the guideline that made some of our choices for us. And yes, it's about struggling actors, but it doesn't really fit in with, like, L.A. Confidential or Hollywoodland or some of those films.
Yeah.
So,
I agree.
But, a great choice. We love Swingers. And we'll get to a little bit more top five Hollywood films feedback here later in the show. But if you do have feedback for us, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, or send us a short MP3 clip. You can also leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-CINNA, 206-203-2463. We'd love to hear from you.
When we come back, Adam and I take a left at the fork in the road on our way to solve the mystery of last week's Massacre Theater, plus a visit to the coal mines of Kentucky in Barbara Copple's Harlan County, USA. Stay with us.
It's almost true. You don't expect to follow, watching what you do. I talked my way, half the night in overdrive, with nowhere else to stay.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Van Halgren. Last week, Adam and I massacred the Muppet movie, Fozzie the Bear, and Gonzo the whatever he is in Jim Henson's 1979 movie, a tie-in with last week's top five movies about Hollywood. Adam, reach into that Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is, unbelievable, Colin
Sharkskin Revolver
Epstein.
Lucky
it
day.
Is Colin. It is his lucky day. He gets red on air and he wins. a DVD. So congratulations, Colin. Yeah. Email feedback at filmspotting.net. We'll set you up with the DVD of your choice. And our apologies to Rachel Falk, who wrote in, our good friend from New York, Rachel, who wrote in and said, I'm so winning with this one. She thought, I have to win, please. I was an original member of the Muppet Show fan club, and I have the button and certificate to prove it. She even attached two photos of her as a child. Seriously, is there anything cuter? And check out that wallpaper. It's Rachel in a garbage can being Oscar the Grouch. If she gives us permission, we'll post him on our website in the notes. We also got a great one, Sam, from Stephen Quirk in Portland, Maine. Stephen Von Quirk is what he's, not Van, but Von.
It's more appropriate, yeah.
It is, and he wrote in and says, you know, it's the Muppet movie, and he sent us a really great graphic from our old Cinecast AV days, but instead of Adam and Sam, it's Fozzie Kempenbear and Kermit Van Hallgren,
yeah.
Yeah, so
very nice.
We are going to post that. You'll also find that link to our fan stuff page. Really great. We appreciate those from Rachel and from Stephen Quirk.
Now you guys gotta look menacing. Can you be more menacing?
And action.
Time for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and as always, it ties in with our top five, yeah. So think about movies. Well, you won't have to think about it by the time you get into the show, because we're going to mention the film that this ties into.
That's
it's
true.
That simple. It's going to come up in our top five, one of our top fives, if not both. A tie-in with that, some kind of director or actor or whatever, it will be connected to some movie that's coming out this fall.
Right.
Okay, so Sam, you start.
Okay.
And I will give you the action. And action.
What you doing?
I remember the first time I met Blank. I know there's something up. I know she's doing something, but I can't catch her.
Maybe she's afraid you're going to hit her, so she can't talk to you the way she wants to.
What do you mean?
Try talking to her. She's your wife. Ask her what's the matter.
When I'm away, did you ever notice anything funny with her? Tell me the truth.
If there was something funny, I would tell you.
I want you to keep an eye on her when I'm not here. Understand?
Sure. I'll keep an eye on her.
And scene. Not bad, Sam.
Well,
not bad.
Some restraint.
Okay. Yeah, some restraint.
Some bad acting. Some restraint equals Massacre Theater.
Some bad acting? If you know what film
100% bad acting.
Sam and I just massacred, send us an email by Monday, September 25th to feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show.
But we'd like to have every man that'll walk his picket duty with us to get his name before he leaves, and we'll break it up. These boys on this committee will break it down, and we'll get something going here. Come on up and sit around. It ain't no big thing. You ain't gonna be doing nothing no way. Crying about how broke you are like I am.
I like it, sir. We sure appreciate that. You would like it, sir.
We're protesting. We're protesting Duke Power's control over these men that voted in the UMW contract, and Duke Power says, no, you can't have that contract.
Adam, like last week's film, D.A. Pennybaker's Don't Look Back, Barbara Koppel couldn't really have anticipated exactly what her film was going to end up being about. She had a subject, the prolonged, sometimes violent 1973 mining strike in Harlan County, Kentucky, but she didn't have a specific agenda. Koppel isn't at all an objective observer, but her goal was to make a record of the events, and the film is the result of a filmmaker sticking with a group of people and documenting what happens. And if Pennybaker's film was the progenitor of 10,000 far inferior behind-the-music rock docs, it's easy to see Barbara Koppel's Harlan County, USA as the agitprop inspiration for the films of people like Michael Moore. Now, living as we do in an age of on-screen documentary personalities like Moore, did you, while watching Harlan County, ever wish for Michael Moore to leap from behind the camera and start shaming coal execs into action? Or was Koppel's take a refreshing, egoless reminder of another way of inspiring change?
Well, no, I certainly wasn't longing for Michael Moore to jump out. And I love Roger and Me, and I love parts of some of his other films, but I wasn't certainly looking for Michael Moore. I actually love the balance of the direct cinema approach that you get in Don't Look Back, and Koppel inserting herself into the action. I think she does it just enough to make it interesting.
Mostly off camera, yeah.
Mostly off camera, yeah, or almost all off camera, really. And I do think that anybody out there who's interested in documentaries or just interested in film, I think this film was powerful enough and important enough that you need to see it. As a documentary, beyond the fact that it won an Oscar, I think that it must be seen because, as you mentioned, it really is a link between Pennebaker and these films, these direct cinema films where the filmmaker is trying to stay out of the action as much as possible. We see it with Pennebaker and Frederick Wiseman. And later, the evolution is to Michael Moore and Ross McElwee with Sherman's March, them being directly part of the action, them moving the story forward and it being their own personal kind of essay in a way. You've got a great middle ground here. You've got that second step in the evolution of the documentary here where you've got her being this person who you do hear her occasionally talk to characters off screen and talk to the subjects. And you know, it is clear where she stands. She isn't an objective observer. I think that mainly comes through in the music, which we'll talk about. Mm. But as, you know, the Florence Reese song we hear throughout the film, "Which Side Are You On?" You know which side she's
yeah,
on.
Of course.
But there is a great scene where she interacts with Basil Collins, who becomes the real villain of this film in some way, this gun thug, a strike-breaking guy who's trying to, you know, intimidate them away from the strike. But on the whole, she really does. What's really great about this film is she really lets the editing, I think, and the images ultimately speak for themselves. She undercuts the arguments you see of the company, this coal mining company that's owned by a huge oil company, where, you know, they're talking about how black lung isn't real. But you get all these shots juxtaposed with that of miners clearly suffering from that, and a doctor telling about how it's a very real problem and just how serious it is. And, you know, you get an exec talking about how they're trying to upgrade housing conditions, juxtaposed with
the terrible shacks
that they live in and just how depraved those conditions are. So I think on the whole, she really does let it kind of stand on its own.
Right.
But she obviously lived with these people for like 13 months. It's clearly their side of the story.
Right.
And you only get the company side of the story in kind of canned press conference moments. But as that step to, as you said, leading to Michael Moore, you got to see Harlan County.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you bring up that point where clearly she has spent a lot of time with these people. And I remember thinking, I mean, it's very easy to imagine this same film with the Michael Moore, you know, I mean, absolutely. It fits right into the shape of his films. But I couldn't quite imagine Michael Moore putting the kind of time and energy that she seemed to. Not saying he's the lazy filmmaker by any means, but you can just sense the way she integrated into this whole community, I think, particularly. And like you said, she lets these people that she documents speak for themselves, and they're wonderfully articulate.
Amazingly.
About it. Amazingly articulate. And you really just get a sense of not only the current problem that's going on, but the history. Not only the history of this area, but also the history of unions and the struggle that unions have had, you know, integrating themselves into industrial capitalist America,
right,
on the struggles that continue to go on. I mean, I was just looking, of course, you know, we've had, you know, the U.S. has had 21 mine-related deaths this year already. You know, the most it's had in over a decade, of course, there were the Sago mine explosion in January where 12 miners were killed. And you just, I mean, that's another sense where you get the relevancy of a film like this. I mean, that, you know, it's easy to avert our eyes from this kind of situation, you know, where, you know, and filmmakers like Barbara Koppel do sort of bring it to light. And it's not something that it's not easy to go and pay attention to these things.
No.
And I think what Barbara Koppel does is give these people a chance to make a really compelling argument on their own, as opposed to...
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I think that something you mentioned off air, Sam, was this documentary marathon. People that maybe haven't seen a lot of them maybe have this misperception that you even experience
sometimes,
where you feel like I have to sit down and watch something that's going to be very dry and very academic and
maybe
more
even
boring,
preach to me and what can
preachy,
I do about it?
Yeah. And it's not going to be as interesting as a fiction film. And I have to say that, of course, you find with documentaries that usually isn't the case. A lot of them are really brilliant and intense
and engaging,
and
just as engaging
and entertaining. And Harlan County, while it's not entertaining, it does, and John Sayles says this on the Criterion Collection disc
too.
A little bit. Yeah. It plays out. I noticed this absolutely myself, that it unfolds a lot of ways like a fiction film does. There is a sense of drama there. You know this violence is coming. It's building to a mass, just like a fiction film would. And I was never, ever bored by Harlan County.
No.
And I never felt like it was a treatise on the history of mine workers. It's not, because it's about these personal stories. And I was, I have to say, kind of as on the edge of my seat as you can be watching a documentary, because this struggle is so epic and so difficult to watch, really. And I have to say, you know, it ultimately was really unsettling for me. There's one shot in particular, and I doubt that this is the shot that Koppel intended to be the one everyone took away from it. But for me, watching the like 3-year-old girl getting bathed in a bathtub, not a tub, but a basin.
Yeah, that she couldn't even fit
in. She's too big for now. And the mom is talking about how when they get a new contract, Daddy will be able to, we'll have a real tub that you can sit in and we'll have hot water. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really, I can't stop thinking about that, actually. And I mean, it sounds cliche, but you think about how much we take for granted. And I mean, my kids get to get in a bathtub with hot running water. And, you know, you think about that girl trying to squeeze into that. And of course, she doesn't really know that she has as rough a life as she does.
And that character isn't moaning and whining about the fact.
It's
a reality.
And there's a dignity about it. But
absolutely.
But that scene really hit me hard. And so on the whole, the film really had a big impact on me. But I do have to say, if I had a complaint about the film, I have a couple things I want to bring up about the movie. And the first one is the music. Hmm. Here's a case where I actually think that Koppel hurts her own cause by being so one-sided. You don't need, as often as we hear it, the union songs as much as we hear it. At first, I really liked it. I mean, Hazel Collins, Matewan Sales ended up using her based on Harlan County. Right. These songs are amazing. The voices are amazing. The stories they have to tell are amazing and important. But it started to feel to me like a crutch. Every other transition, mm-hmm. I had to hear Hazel Collins belting out a song. And it just felt like that's a moment where I know what her perspective is. I don't need the songs then hitting me over the head with this struggle, this epic struggle. I can see it for myself, and I felt like it was a little heavy-handed beyond just being, and again, I like the music.
I understand
why Sales did
That's
it.
That's interesting.
But I felt like I liked it the first 5 or 6 times. I didn't need it 10 or 11. But what I will say about it, to counter my own point there, is that what's great about the music is that, and you mentioned this, the history. It keeps everything in this historical perspective. You can't remove it from its historical context. These are people who, my real sensation watching the film by the end of it is these are people who are in some sense trapped by history.
Yeah.
And the music reflects that. They're constantly talking about how this struggle compares to the bloody Harlan days back in the 30s. And they're always saying that, well, it's not so bad. It's not as bad as it was back then. That's something that kind of keeps them going in a way, is that, like, you can't complain about this because it's nothing like it was in the 30s, which in a way then deflects just how bad it really is.
Yeah.
They kind of, in a way, it allows them to forget almost, you know, that really, no, this is not going to end happily necessarily, but they keep telling themselves that. And the way that they feel like, well, it's worked before, so if we just remain, you know, we have solidarity,
right,
we'll stand prevail shoulder to shoulder, and it's just not that simple. I mean, they trap themselves, I think, because they have this great, you know, as we said, dignity and toughness, and the way they articulate themselves, I think it's easy for us Yankees up here to speculate what a bunch of uneducated people in Kentucky in a coal mining town are going to act like. And you know what, they can articulate themselves better than we do most of the time on this show. They're very smart people, and I really enjoyed that part of it as well. But I felt like, in a way, you know, it does hurt them. It traps them. This world is changing. These companies are not the same. They're now owned by huge conglomerates. And, and somehow they hurt their own cause by trying to relate it to their history. The old rules don't apply anymore.
Right.
And yet they're trying to apply those old rules.
Right. We're not making 36 cents today. We're making, you know, $3 or $4 an hour instead.
Yeah.
And yeah, you saw that there's that one scene with the man standing on the picket line on Wall Street, and having a kind of wonderful conversation that she and her crew catch, this picketer with a policeman. And he's saying, actually, he actually says, you know, oh, we're getting paid all right. It's just that, you know, we don't have any kind of pension. They're not giving us any kind of, they're not giving us dental, medical, or anything like that. And it's just kind of shocking to hear. And you're like, you're not getting paid well enough.
Yeah.
I know that.
Right.
But you're right. I love that point about the fact that they're kind of stuck in history. I think you see that time and time again. I saw it as, you know, you get a sense, a richness to the whole thing because of the history. But you're absolutely right to point out the fact that, yeah, maybe by using that as their measuring stick, they're not giving themselves nearly enough.
Yeah, I mean, it is who they are. These songs and this history obviously define them. It's why they stay where they are. It's, you know, their daddy's worked in the mine, their daddy's daddy worked in the mine. That's the way it is. But in a way, it's just that paradigm doesn't exist anymore. And I think that's really what you see happen in this film, kind of the way it unfolds. And I will say one other thing that is a little bit of a complaint to me. And if I miss something here, please, if, you know, my brain was shut off and whatever, and I didn't catch this. But one issue I had is that I never really felt like, you talk about this a lot with our fiction films we review, the stakes of the film.
Yeah.
Because while it's immediately clear from the beginning that they don't have safe conditions, that they're getting paid way too little, that they don't have enough benefits, that's all very clear. The problem is, I never had a sense of what exactly they were fighting for.
Yeah.
And I think in some way it hurts their, it undermines the whole film and their argument. I was reading about Koppel's 1990 documentary, which also won an Oscar, called American Dream, which is about this Hormel packing plant, meat packing plant in Minnesota. And it's very clear there what's at stake. The plant is paying them $10.69 an hour. I haven't seen it, but what I've read about it, and they want to reduce it to wages that are more comparable to what other plants pay. They want to pay them 8.25. Obviously, the employees don't want to take that pay cut, and they strike. But when you know that,
yeah, that's pretty clear.
You
right?
know exactly what they're fighting for. You know how far apart the gulf is, and you know what each side wants and how they might at some point get there. Here, it just feels kind of nebulous in some way, where it's like,
we want them to improve,
we want things to be safer. But I never got the sense of, well, what three things do you want that will make you safer?
Right.
What three things do you want done that will give you more benefits and better pay? I don't think that was as clear as it should have been. And in some way, like I said, it hurts the miners' argument, because then they just come off as sort of, really outraged, yeah, but without any kind of organization or plan.
Right. And I think, I mean, you mentioned that this film does follow a kind of arc, a narrative arc in some way. And I think it becomes more clear, that story becomes more clear in the second half of the film.
Yeah.
I want to say, like, about the first half, she's introducing a lot of interesting elements, like the dilemma within the union itself. Are they in bed with the industry already? Mm-hmm. You know, she's introducing a lot of characters. And again, I think that's part of where it gets lost. What exactly are they fighting for? Part of it, they're just fighting for the best, you know, leadership in the union.
Yes.
They're fighting for a union. They don't belong to a union to begin with, you know? And then, so there's, I think you're right. I think she could have done a couple quick and easy things to make the argument clearer, because I don't think it's necessarily the miners' fault necessarily. I think it may have been how those points were articulated.
Yes, exactly.
To us.
Yeah. I agree completely.
But really, truly moving and interesting and
powerful.
You mentioned Sales important. Too. He said, you know, he says, I'll take a documentary over a feature film just about any day. Mm-hmm. And it's because you get this insight into a community you wouldn't otherwise. And that's always going to be not only more educational, but it's also going to be more moving. It's going to offer you an experience that you go to the movies for in some way. You're going to be engaged in characters, engaged in their stories, moved by them.
Mm-hmm.
And this film absolutely gives you that.
Well, that moment I said with that 3-year-old girl, it hits me so much more knowing it's real.
Right.
You know, it really does. So it is an important film and one definitely worth checking out. Next week in the marathon, we will get to Hearts and Minds, Peter Davis's controversial Oscar-winning 1974 documentary about the Vietnam War. Actually, we should have done Hearts and Minds first because it was earlier. Somehow I got the dates turned around. Doesn't matter. Harlan County, on to Hearts
Very
and Minds
similar
next
time
week.
Period, too. Yeah. Probably filmed almost, probably simultaneously. All right, well, time for one more quick break. When we come back, our top 5 most anticipated movies of 2006, The Redux, is next.
Kingdom. Don't you wanna come in high all the way to the other side? Your turn falling didn't land at all, and some would say was never gone. Can't you stand to something stopped you, but the lens it changed is you pulled away. Come to play out all the hooks to hang around, swinging through, cut me.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam. It is top 5 time. We'll get into that here in a second. But briefly, we just wanted to mention a quick note, and that is that next week we're doing something a little bit different. I'm not sure how it's going to play, but we're going to give it a try. And that is, we're going to do our bonus show, what would normally come out on Friday when we do our WBEZ edition of the show,
right,
Chicago Public Radio. We're going to do that show on Wednesday. So on Wednesday, you're going to get a review of Idiocracy, the new Mike Judge movie.
Yes.
You're also going to hear our discussion of Hearts and Minds, the documentary. And then our full show, the full Chicago Public Radio edition of the show with reviews of all the Kingsmen, The Last Kiss, that is going to actually go up late Saturday night.
Yeah.
Reason being that we're actually going to hold it for the show, the WBEZ show, so it plays
the
air, on
the
air
actual
first.
Air.
We're going to give this a shot, see how this model goes. Right. We may not end up doing this in the future. We may do it all the time. We don't know yet, but we're going to give it a shot. So Saturday night, and hey, if you don't have a chance to listen, at least look at it this way. Come Monday morning, for those of you who listen on your commute or whatever, Monday morning you'll have a new show to listen to and take with you
enjoy.
So yeah, that's my spin. So anyway, we wanted to make that very clear that that will be happening. Next week will be a little bit different. Also, we wanted to mention a last bit of top 5 feedback. We got some great stuff and wanted to read this one from Sean Lane in Chicago about his favorite Hollywood movies. But before you read it, Sam, I just want to say something. Sometimes this happens where we review a movie. We both have a real major thought about the film, and a lot of people are talking about it, and somehow we talk about it for 20 minutes and never mention that one thing.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I know it frustrates some listeners. It frustrates us. And one thing about The Black Dahlia is we didn't mention Hilary Swank once.
Right.
So let's literally take like 30 seconds to discuss, because her performance is one of those kind of over-the-top, showy, stylized performances.
Can't be possibly.
What did you think of it?
Yeah, I mean, it was another situation where I was just kind of amazed that she was giving this performance. She's put on this really strange kind of accent that is like a East Coast kind of accent, possibly like a Boston Ivy League educated kind of accent. We learned that her parents are Scottish or something. And it's just one of those things where it just makes you uncomfortable. I like Hilary Swank. I think she's deserved both of her Oscars. She's a very talented actress, as my wife would say when she's playing a man. But not at all believable as a femme fatale.
Okay.
At all.
I kind of disagree with you, actually. I actually enjoyed Hilary Swank's performance as one of the stylized performances that didn't go too far into camp, that, to use your phrase, actually was someone having fun in the role, the way Bob Hoskins
disagree.
A little bit in Hollywoodland, some of those people that were eating up the scenery a little bit, but not too much. I kind of thought Hilary Swank was actually interesting. I did.
We'll go, okay, well, she walked away then fairly unscathed.
Unscathed.
In this travesty.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and read this one then from Sean in Chicago. Sean Lane, when I heard the latest top five subject, one film popped immediately to my mind, Ed Wood, one of my favorite films of all time. How did you miss this gem? To me, every other Hollywood movie either looks at the private lives of stars or explores the seamy underbelly of life in L.A., a la L.A. Confidential. What I loved about Ed Wood is how it told the story of the Hollywood losers that are basically good people but who lack the talent to see it through to stardom. Great acting all around. Great show. Keep up the good work. Sam, explain yourself.
Well, I can, I guess, in that Ed Wood is a film, when I saw it, I didn't like it as much as I thought I would.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I always meant to, it's like, admired it, liked it, but left it kind of, I was a little bored by it. I was never really taken with it. And maybe it's this, I wasn't able to identify this problem earlier, but Johnny Depp.
You've come to really.
Probably was Johnny Depp. Like, yeah. I wonder if he disrupted my feelings about that.
He was playing the cello again.
Apparently he was playing the cello, slowing down the whole thing.
The whole film.
So I think, I mean, I actually was on IFC over this weekend. I was hoping to catch it. Wasn't able to, because I wanted to revisit it, because I know a lot of people mentioned it. I didn't get a chance, but I do want to do it in the future, but I may realize 5 minutes in that, it's just the Johnny Depp syndrome.
Yeah.
He's earned another.
No, but Sean definitely is not alone with Ed Wood. And I have to say, I do really like Ed Wood. It was considered, just didn't crack my top 10. So I do like Ed Wood a lot, though. But let's get into the top five. And this was a suggestion, actually, from our friend Matt Singer over at IFC, who mentioned that, you know, we should really count down our fall movies. And at first we thought, well, we kind of already
did that.
We did our most anticipated movies of 2006, and of course the mistake there was we just should have done like a summer preview or something and not the entire year, because there are so many movies coming out now that we're aware of that we weren't aware of then, that there really are enough to highlight, and we want to take a few moments to highlight some of those movies that if we hadn't even heard of them, chances are a lot of our listeners haven't heard of them either. We want to shine a spotlight on those a little bit. So Sam, how did you form your list, or give us a little bit of setup, and then quickly your 6 through 10.
Okay, yeah, I mean, really is just that we have a lot more information. Some of the films that, you know, were on our 10 films we talked about back in February on the most anticipated of 2006, some of them have been pushed back to 2007. And again, like you said, a lot of films I didn't even realize were being made by filmmakers I really admire. Turned out they're coming out this year. But my 6 through 10, I've got The Fountain, which was actually my number 3 most anticipated, and I have to say it's the fact that I'm equally looking forward to and really fearful of this movie. The fantastic millennia-spanning love story, honestly, doesn't really interest me. The trailer doesn't do much for me. Jackman and Weiss don't do much for me. It's Aronofsky. I'm going to see this movie because of him and his ambition and this whole thing, and I just hope it's better than... And it's not that it looks bad. The trailer looks bad or the story looks uninteresting. I just... The only thing that's truly drawing me, the reason I mention it, is because of Darren Aronofsky.
Fair enough.
I've got The Last King of Scotland with my up-and-coming actor, Forrest Whitaker,
Real
at 45 years old. It seems like he's getting this role. I haven't seen Bird that he played when he was 26. I think it's been nearly 20 years since Bird came out, Clint Eastwood's film about Charlie Parker. Yeah, and other than Ghost Dog, Jarmusch's Ghost Dog, I don't think Whitaker's been given much of a chance, and here's playing the madman Idi Amin.
Yes.
Finally. Gets a part that he's deserving of. I've got Fast Food Nation on here. I've heard, you've told me, that one of the critics for Premiere has said suggested that it may be the worst film of the year.
Yes.
Based on the preview, the ensemble cast, it looks really intriguing to me.
Okay.
I'm still interested. I've got The Departed on here as my number 2 film of the year. It's the Basson accents that I'm a little worried about.
Okay.
Honestly. And Todd Fields, finally, Little Children. Obviously, somebody's drawn to really disturbing material. Great cast, though, with Kate Winslet, Jennifer Connelly, and the original Kelly Leak, Earl Haley, about infidelity and child molestation.
Well,
looks like heavy stuff, but I'm looking forward
to it. Another movie, Todd Field adapting a short story, just like he did with In the Bedroom.
And
we should announce, actually, that we've been in conversation with Todd Field, and it looks like in October he's going to be our featured guest here on the show to talk about Little Children. So look forward to that. My 6 through 10, Borat. I mentioned earlier in a review of something, the humor, Snakes on a Plane, I think it was.
No, that's right.
That Borat was the funniest thing I'd seen all year, the trailer for it.
Right.
Casino Royale. I'm not a big Bond guy. I'm really not, but the trailer looks good. The origin story, like Batman, that they've given to this, it looks grittier, darker.
It's a good idea. Yeah.
And I kind of liked Layer Cake. I didn't love it as much as a lot of our listeners did, but Daniel Craig, I think, is really cool. Look forward to seeing it. I've got The Science of Sleep.
Can't believe you didn't say anything
about Ava Green. How did I mention Ava Green, who I absolutely adore? Of course, that's why I'm going
to
see it. You're right, Freckles, as you call her. The Science of Sleep, Michelle Gondry, directed, Gael Garcia Bernal. Short Bus, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
We will post the link to the unrated trailer. Just don't watch it at work. And lastly, The Good German, Steven Soderbergh's new film, Cate Blanchett, who is luminous. We love Cate Blanchett and George Clooney in that as well. So that's our 6 through 10. Let's get into the top five. The number five film you're most anticipating this fall, this holiday season, is?
I'm going to let it speak for itself just for a moment.
What is a nut, jokes?
A nut joke, I would say, that suit is black. Not.
This suit is not black.
No, no, not has to be the end.
Okay.
Okay.
This suit is black nut.
This suit is black. Pause. You know what a pause is?
Yes. This suit is black.
Okay.
Yes, that's Sacha Baron Cohen. You mentioned it. Borat. Cultural Learnings of America for Make Benefit Glorious Nation of Kazakhstan. Directed by Larry Charles. I mean, honestly, I'm a fan of Baron Cohen's Ali G show where, you know, Borat made his first appearances. And although, you know, it does look like really this is just loosely assembled scenes that, you know, may or may not have been filmed during or after Ali G, it still is guaranteed to be probably among the funniest things you've seen all year. That clip probably will give you some indication. I insist you go watch the rest of it. But yeah, I think Sacha Baron Cohen, despite feeling mixed about his performance in Talladega Nights, is clearly a comic genius, and this is obviously worth seeing.
Well, the second trailer, the first one was funny, but the second one I saw before, I think it was maybe Snakes on a Plane, I was in tears laughing at how funny that was. So check that out. My number five is actually Mark Forster's Stranger Than Fiction. Forster directed Monsters Ball, Stay, Finding Neverland, and it's got Will Ferrell, who we love, as a character, Harold Crick, and Emma Thompson, who we also love. She's a writer. It's her novel, and she's trying to kill him, but he's real. He can actually hear her narration. I'm going to play just quickly a scene from it here to give you the idea of what's going on.
Dave, I'm being followed.
How are you being followed? You're not moving.
It's by a woman's voice. She's narrating.
Go.
Harold couldn't concentrate on his work.
I can't think while you're talking.
You have a voice speaking to you.
About me, accurately, and with a better vocabulary.
Harold found himself exasperated.
Shut up!
Cursing the heavens in futility.
No, I'm not. I'm cursing you, you stupid voice! So shut up and leave me alone!
So I love those kind of break the fourth wall, those creativity stories, the stories of creation of characters you get certainly with like Being John Malkovich and those kind of stories and adaptation. Dustin Hoffman, Maggie Gyllenhaal, shot in Chicago largely, if not completely. So I am really looking forward. It's bumped up the list.
I have to say, I was worried when I saw the preview, the description of it. It looked like Charlie Kaufman light. I didn't really, and reports out of Toronto anyway that I've read are that it's just that, and it's out of my top 10 anticipated list. I mean, I just, my concerns of it have been verified just based on opinion. I hope I'm wrong. I hope they're wrong.
You will be wrong.
I hope I am. Like I said, I'm an optimist, but that's all right. It's a totally legitimate choice. Number four, I do have Michelle Gondry's Signs of Sleep. Speaking of Charlie Kaufman, here's somebody that directed Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, as well as Kaufman's Human Nature. I just think it has a chance to be one of the best films of the year, and that's why I'm really excited about it. I think equally it could be, you know, just kind of cute and, you know, in a way, like I'm worried when I see the preview in that it's a little too taken with its sort of visual look. I'm worried that it may overshadow the relationships in the film. I had those same fears about Eternal Sunshine, honestly, and those were unmet, those concerns. I think this film could equally be as moving.
Okay. Well, before we get to my number four, I will mention real quick, Stranger Than Fiction comes out November 10th. My number four film comes out October 20th, and that is The Prestige, our second magic movie of the year. Hugh Jackman, Christian Bale, Michael Caine in a Christopher Nolan film. The pedigree, I think, kind of speaks for itself. Rival magicians in turn of the century London. I'm looking forward to seeing it just for that cast and that director, and I think the trailer is really effectively creepy.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's my number three, Prestige, and I think it's everything to do with the trailer. Honestly, with Christopher Nolan, with Batman Begins, I was, you know, we weren't really taken with that. I didn't think his Insomnia was all that good. Of course, I love Memento, but, you know, the trailer, I think it looks like he's back. I'm really thrilled about this.
Okay. Well, my number three, I cheated. It's a tie, and I have a tie because they're both connected in that they are big political movies about characters who get too caught up in their own power, basically, which would have been a nice tie-in with Tony Boyle from Harlan County,
God,
USA,
yeah.
The United Mine Workers Association. The first time you see Tony Boyle talk, you really think he's a madman who would probably kill his opponent. And then you come to find out
he
actually murdered his opponent. Really, go watch Harlan County just to see
it's
that. It is shocking. But September 22nd opens next weekend, All the King's Men.
Yeah.
We have been promoting it on the show. I'm not going to go into any great details about it with that cast. I want to see it.
Yeah.
But also The Last King of Scotland. You mentioned Forrest Whitaker as Idi Amin. Just supposedly a powerhouse performance, and it's all told through the perspective of his Scottish personal
physician. Right.
So I just think I was curious about it. Oh, also, Kevin MacDonald, who made the documentary, the great documentary, One Day in September, about Munich, the 1972 Olympics. Great film. He is directing this, so that's another reason why I'm looking forward to it. But I really love Forrest Whitaker, and I saw the preview, and it instantly shot up my list.
Yeah, my number two was number one on my original list, and it's Alejandro Gonzalez in Iñárritu's Babel. Brad Pitt, Kate Blanchett, Gael Garcia Bernal. I've liked 21 Grams, I liked Amoris Perros, and I liked what he and Guillermo Arriaga do with their kind of thematic ambition, you know, and the fact that it's almost pretentious, like, and I think you might say 21 Grams maybe goes over the edge into pretension. I think the movies are more memorable and greater, have a greater impact on me because they risk being pretentious, and I think absolutely succeed. He's great with actors. He's great with these, you know, these ambitious stories. I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, me too. It's my number two, and I'm not sure if it was in my top five or not, actually. Looking at my list, it wasn't, which is shocking. It was your number one back on our list, Cinecast number 76 from February.
We
did it. And now it's shot up to number two because of the trailer as well. I think it's incredible. I obviously like Arriaga. I liked Three Burials of Melquiades, which you didn't, which he wrote. And obviously Iñárritu, Amores Perros, I love. And 21 Grams, I find really fascinating, if not love as much as Amores Perros. But three stories supposedly set in this wide-ranging global universe of Morocco, Tunisia, Mexico, Japan. I love Blanchett, as I said, and even Brad Pitt, who annoys the hell out of me, doesn't look annoying in the trailer. I love how
he's given a lot of business to do. Yeah,
I love how haggard he looks. Yeah. It could work.
Are
he
you
may
as
not
worried as I am, though, about Kate Blanchett being like shot in the belly for the entire movie?
Yeah,
I'm a little worried that it's like, does she get to walk around? Do we get flashbacks at all?
I'm sure we do a little bit. But it's funny because one of our listeners, Aaron Walker, wrote in and mentioned a top five suggestion: movies that render you worthless.
Oh,
they
leave
you stunned and mute for hours. And I think we kind of did that with our one timers. That basically is it. Movies like Requiem for a Dream.
Right.
But Babel, I have to say, has that top five written all over
absolutely.
It, much like his previous films there. So I am really dying to see Babel now. And I just want to throw in real quick, because as we know, going back to our religious movies, I am a biblical scholar.
Yes, that's right.
I am.
Oh, I always forget that.
Yeah, I am an actual Christian scriptures expert. And of course, this isn't the Christian scriptures, so I have no I have no academic standing here, unfortunately. But I just wanted to throw in that there's a very clear nod to the religious story from Genesis 11, Babel, getting it from the story of the Tower of Babel. I just want to throw in there, another reason I am excited about the film is that's like my favorite biblical passage.
I always loved it too. The story itself.
No, that's what I mean. It's my favorite chapter, because you've got in 9 and 10, Noah, God has basically said, I'm so unhappy with the world.
Yeah.
I'm going to flood, you know, I'm bringing the flood. I'm ruining everything.
I've
handpicked my ideal guy, Noah, and his family. We're going to repopulate the world. Everything is going to be golden. I've got exactly how I want it. We're all going to be on the same page. Everyone's speaking the same language. Cut to chapter 11, right? This has happened. Now you've got Nimrod. You've got Nimrod, this king or whatever.
King
and
Nimrod,
he tries to build the tower up to heaven. And that pisses God off so much that he throws into chaos everything he just got done doing. He makes everyone speak a different language.
He's like, everyone's, I've got time on my hands.
Yeah,
that's
everyone's
fine.
On the same page, 9 and 10. Ruin everything. Get us all on the same page. Now we're all speaking different languages.
Wrath of God.
It's... It blew my mind.
Awesome stuff.
It is good stuff.
My number one is Steven Soderbergh's The Good German. You mentioned it. Did you mention it in your 6 through 10?
I did.
And it was in your top 5, I think, back in the day.
I think it was in my 6 through 10 there as well.
For some reason, I overlooked it at the time. I think at the time it was unclear if it was being released this year.
Right, it's coming out around Christmas.
Yeah, Christmas time. Cate Blanchett, George Clooney, Tobey Maguire. It's black and white Casablanca kind of thing. We've got post-war Berlin and Clooney finds his former mistress. He's an American journalist lured into a murder mystery. And I love Soderbergh. I'll see anything he does. And it seems like it's not a Soderbergh we've seen before, really, other than it is Soderbergh, fulfilling his love of cinema. He did the Solaris. He did the Tarkovsky remake. His Ocean's 11, obviously, nod to some classic characters. And I'm just looking forward to him exploring this new arena. So
yeah, no, it's Blanchett and it is Soderbergh, and even though Clooney as an actor doesn't always hold up for me, he picks such interesting projects.
Agreed.
And working with Clooney that I give him the benefit of the doubt. So my number one is the film that was my number one back then. Mm. I still have to give it to The Departed, Martin Scorsese's.
There is no pain.
Nice
you
job,
are.
Sam.
Receiving.
Yeah. The Departed comes out November 6th, and I wrote about this in the Dope Sheet a while back. I kind of reviewed the trailer for the film because I was so excited about it. And as I wrote then, it didn't blow me away, but I have such high expectations for the film because I love the Hong Kong version, Infernal Affairs, that it's based on.
Yeah,
rival cops, both undercover. It's transplanted from Hong Kong to South Boston. And as I said then, I'm not sure that DiCaprio and Damon can pull off the gravitas of Tony Leung and Andy Lau. They just seem so boyish compared to those two great actors.
You want to chop me up and feed me to the poor?
Nicely done. Nicely done. But it's still Scorsese and the cast with those two, Nicholson, Alec Baldwin, Martin Sheen, Mark Wahlberg, and Ray Winston, all in the same movie.
Amazing.
And it is, like
it's
I said, based
testosterone
on
testosterone fest. It's amazing.
Infernal Affairs. I am still really dying to see the next Scorsese film. It's still my number one.
All right. No, I'm looking forward to it, too. I think I have the same concerns you do, but I'm excited.
Okay.
All right. Well, that's our top five. Please send any feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message.
Opening this weekend, the Project Greenlight Creation Feast. James Franco starring in yet another movie no one wants to see.
This guy is on a
Flyboys. Flyboys, that's his
Flyboys.
Movie? Yeah, it looks brutal.
Terrible.
Yeah, and he's in that.
I think they say, this is how they sell it. From the producers of Godzilla.
Right.
James Franco doesn't need any more help.
You know what?
Than that.
That's a great message board topic, David Letterman.
Yes, it is.
As you do that with your papers again, is message board topic the top five bad reasons?
You know it's going to be a bad movie.
Yeah, you know it's going to be a bad movie. Top five clues a movie will suck. You say the Godzilla thing. Number one,
James Franco.
Lewis Black is in your film.
Oh man,
we didn't even talk about how bad he is.
He's so bad.
And then now he's in that Man of the Year movie.
Yeah,
and I think he has a prominent role.
You've said this about you've been dissing on the Man of the Year. I like every time I see the preview.
Oh, I don't know.
I like it.
Oh, I don't know.
I don't know.
There's a couple funny lines, but
I guess
anyway,
it's a couple funny lines.
Okay, Jackass 2 is coming out. I know Sam is going to be in line.
I've already bought my ticket.
I know. And Jet Li's Fearless. We'll have reviews of Steven Zaillian's adaptation of Robert Penn Warren's All the King's Men, as well as we'll take a look at Zach Braff in
Garden
The
State
Last
2.
Kiss, right. Garden State 2. And we think we're going to do our top five political pictures, which does overlap with something we did way back in the 40s, Cinecast 40s,
with
movies
conscience.
With a conscience. Obviously, we'll come up with movies that don't fall into those lists, and I think they have to be overtly political.
Yes.
They have to be, like All the King's Men, about characters who are in politics.
And can we say it's the honorary...
All the President's Men
that's
Memorial
right.
List.
That's
Is that
right.
what you're trying to say,
that's
Sam?
That's exactly what I'm trying
so
to
anyway,
say.
So anyway, that's next week on Film Spotting, along with the bonus edition of Idiocracy and Hearts and Minds.
Thanks to Richard Buckner and Merge Records for today's music. Please check him out on the web at mergerecords.com. Check out our top five archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more at filmspotting.net. And please help us reach new listeners by voting for us at podcastalley.com. A direct link is available on our blog under Vote for Film Spotting. And also on the blog, sign up for the Dope Sheet, the Film Spotting weekly email blast for Film Spotting. I'm Sam Van Halbert.
I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting. And by All the King's Men, a saga of human nature, power, idealism, romance, and betrayal, using politics as a framework to delve into the more profound dilemmas of human existence, sin, guilt, and redemption. It explores the true nature of corruption. Oscar winner Sean Penn leads the star-studded cast, which includes Oscar nominee Jude Law, Oscar nominee Kate Winslet, and Oscar winner Sir Anthony Hopkins. All the King's Men is in theaters September 22nd.
Last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard from The Muppet Movie. No, I can't do it.
No, you can't.
How does Kermit sound?
I have no idea.
Kermie.
That was better.
The Muppet Movie. No, can't do it. All right, I was going to try. All right.
In the commentary from one of the seasons on DVD, Groening says it's not a haunt.
Groening.
Hold on. Can we just start this whole email over?
Absolutely not.
Is it Groening? Or
I think it is Groening. I thought I saw a pronunciation.
Groening?
I think somebody sent in the pronunciation.
Groening? What is it?
Groening.
Groening?
Yeah. Okay. I'll take a documentary over a feature film just about any day, mm-hmm. and it's because you get this insight into a community you wouldn't otherwise. And that's always going to be not just more educational, but... Don't say anything about
classy.
Kentucky.
Educational?
Educational. Wow, that's good.